Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
Ninth day of May 2022, allegedly according to that thing we call a calendar, and this is indeed the show you were looking for, the O'Chelly Effect. Guess how I know that, because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, it's Monday, but it is early for me. It's just after 3 p.m. Eastern time here in this place we used to call America, and I gotta tell you, this is an unusual time. Why did I make an exception to go live at this time? If you're hearing me on the stream, you're saying to yourself, wait, is he live or not? Yeah, just after 3 p.m. Eastern time on Monday, May 9th. Yeah, I am. But most of you will catch this further on down the stream via your Fondle Slab of Choice, your applicable application, etc., because most of you listen to the podcast anyway. So, we've been doing a series of interviews on Mondays lately of JFK authors that I have not actually had on the show before. And, of course, I had to vet and go through a lot of stuff and once again tell you that not everybody makes the cut to come on this show. Okay, I've read hundreds of books on this case. You're well aware of that if you listen to my show regularly. And I got to tell you that the majority of them are a waste of time. But when I bring an author on, guess what that means? It's not. Joseph McBride doesn't need my praise, doesn't need my approval. He is an interesting fellow all the way around, quite honestly. He's written a lot of other interesting pieces. He's a well-educated individual, all that good stuff. That's why this conversation is going to be unique. And I'll tell you, because here we go again with the guy who got the high school diploma and still sits there and baffles some PhDs, right? I love doing this. I'm not going to baffle Mr. McBride today. I'm going to go through something that he decided to devote a fairly substantial volume to. Now, he's written Into the Nightmare, and I did not interview him on that book yet. I may in the near future if he's got time for me, but I've got to go back over that book. The one that we're talking about today is Political Truth, The Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy. Now, that might sound familiar because it almost sounds like the title of the presentations that I've done. I always focus on the media. I always focus on the trajectory, the interesting coverage and cover-ups that have occurred in the media. This is something I love to focus on. And Joseph McBride does a different sort of job with it than I would. And we're going to discuss that today. But before we get there, first, I got to ask you, how you doing today, Joseph?
Great. Great to be on your show, Chuck.
Okay. You know, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. And again, we did this at a special time. So it's interesting. It's not quite my wheelhouse time. But again, you're very much worth it to change the schedule. So here's the thing. Before we even get into the JFK stuff, I want to tell you that yesterday when I was producing Bob Wilson's show, who you've been on a few times, you've been on a couple of his shows, actually. But I was producing one yesterday where he had Anthony Summers as a guest. And I immediately thought of you because I had to watch this Netflix documentary because I thought I might have to do some background work or something with Bob on the show. Turns out he didn't need me for the interview at all. But I wanted to be prepared, so I watched the documentary. And interesting audio clips in there from guess who? Billy Wilder. Related to Marilyn Monroe.
That's right.
Now, I knew that already because I knew that Wilder had directed one of the most famous Marilyn Monroe films and so on, right? So it was like logical that that was going to come up. But when I was watching the Netflix thing, I was thinking to myself, there's actually the guy's voice, which I don't know. I know you're used to hearing it because you wrote a book on Billy Wilder and you can mention that here today. But again, I'm not prepared to discuss it. It's very interesting. He's an interesting character, Wilder, somebody you knew, and also just a fascinating character historically when it comes to the production of media, etc. So I don't know. I thought of you and I said, gee, I wonder what Joe McBride thinks of the tapes that Anthony Summers might have of Billy Wilder. I mean, you didn't need his tapes, but go ahead.
Interesting to hear his voice. They had actors, you know, portraying the people on screen. I have an interesting anecdote about Billy Wilder and JFK. In 1961, JFK called Billy Wilder to Peter Lawford's guest house in Santa Monica and wanted to meet him. And Wilder went there with his wife, Audrey. And JFK was interested in the fact that Wilder was about to do a satire on the Cold War in Berlin, the divided Berlin, 1-2-3. And Kennedy wanted the script. He was concerned about it, that it might exacerbate the tensions. And Wilder commendably wouldn't give him the script. And that was pretty gutsy, as Wilder always was, because he was, a liberal Democrat and an immigrant. But he wasn't about to let the government censor his script or whatever. So he said he and Kennedy talked about power and women and actresses. Hmm. And Audrey, there's a picture of them. Audrey's doing the New York Times crossword puzzle while her husband's talking to the president. So, anyway.
No, that's an interesting thing because, you know, when people talk about Kennedy in Hollywood, they often talk about Lawford, and they talk about, the 7 days in May thing where he allowed him to film at the White House and this kind of stuff. But there's actually a whole array of things that we could talk about with JFK related to Hollywood. And also Frank Sinatra, obviously, his other people that he had involved in his campaigns, people he had, just as friends. I mean, there's a whole array of stuff. If we wanted to talk about just the Hollywood connection alone to JFK, but
right. This
book is not focusing on that. This book that you put together here, which, by the way, again, a very substantial book. And succeeded in not boring me. Okay, I just want to let you know that. Because I'm very critical of this, where, look, if you're going to write like historians do not have the flair for writing, okay? They never do. Some people are great historians and not great writers. And some people are great writers and seem to not understand history. So I encounter that a lot. Now, you have a grasp on the history, and you're also a talented writer. Now, I don't often say that. I got to tell you.
Well, thank you very much for all the good comments.
But this is fascinating to me because this is not just about JFK's direct connection to the media, which, again, people would say, well, he was the first TV president, et cetera, et cetera. All right, I'm going to just turn this over to you in a minute because there is a lot to, I hate to use this phrase, but unpack here, because we could start with his relationship with the media, which was definitely different. We could start with ghostwriters and talk about his releases of books, and we could talk about all of that, his direct interactions, and then it's almost a completely separate issue with the way he was handled in the media post-mortem, because there's a JFK and his relationship with the media while he was alive, and then there's a JFK again after death, and they are two distinctly different things. Where should we begin, Professor McBride?
Well, Jim DiEugenio, who's a very good writer on the assassination, refers to the posthumous assassination of President Kennedy, in other words, the attacks on him after his death. A lot of them focus on his sex life, which is not terribly important, really, but there are a lot of people who are maligning his policies and distorting them. For example, one of the most important things about the assassination was the fact that Lyndon Johnson changed Kennedy's Vietnam policy surreptitiously on November 24th, 2 days after the assassination. Kennedy had begun his Vietnam pullout. He wanted to have a gradual pullout because he knew the war wasn't being won and couldn't be won. And he had already started pulling out 1,000 troops, but behind his back, some of his aides were revising a National Security Action Memorandum to aim it at a hardline buildup of the war and expansion into North Vietnam. And it's doubtful Kennedy ever saw the document, which was prepared the day before his death. And Johnson wanted to expand the war, and that's what he did on the Sunday. He issued that action memorandum on the 26th, and he met with Henry Cabot Lodge, the ambassador to South Vietnam, and McNamara and Rusk and a couple of other people. And this was not told to the press. The press in one of the many distortions, printed the story that Johnson was just continuing Kennedy's Vietnam policy, but in fact he reversed it secretly while the riots were going on at the Capitol, and Kennedy was lying in state, etc., and those shortly after Oswald was shot. So that's very important. Johnson's one of his first acts was to widen the war, but that's one of the big lies that you read in history books and the press quite often, is that Kennedy's policy was simply bellicose and Johnson was just continuing that. But it's a world of difference, because when Kennedy died, there were about 16,000 U.S. advisors in Vietnam, and Johnson ramped it up to 545,000 troops, and Kennedy was going to pull out by 65 at the latest.
Right. And by the end of calendar year 65, according to the National Security Action Memorandum that he actually saw. Now, this is not just something that was contemporaneous with the action, though, Professor McBride, because as you well know today, and as recently as a couple of years ago when Ken Burns released a massive documentary, right?
That was one of the ones that distorted that important fact.
Did exactly that, which is, say, effectively, although it was interesting to hear from, you know, actual Vietnamese participants in the war, which I think was unique to Burns' documentary, but besides it being a giant sleeping pill, quite honestly, it was also this distortion of, well, Kennedy was just, you know, he was actually enacting policies, and Johnson is the logical continuation. And that has been repeated over and over again, not just in history books, but in documentaries. And so it's fascinating how that continues, because one could say that at the time there might have been a purpose for that, right? There might have been a purpose for saying that he's continuing the policies, like, let's try and go with the benevolent explanation in order to get the civil rights stuff passed, which people point to with Johnson a lot. Again, sort of distorting his character, because Johnson was not really a civil rights advocate, although he did take actions which were politically expedient. There is something to say there where you could say, well, maybe at the time they wanted it to look that way, but no, ever after that's been the distortion. So why would you say that is? Go ahead.
It really killed the war. Really damaged seriously the Great Society, as Johnson called it. He did, you know, he deserves credit for the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and Medicare and some very important things he did get through. Mm-hmm. But and he believed in them. But the war just sapped the treasury, and he didn't raise taxes to pay for it for quite a while, which really caused a lot of inflation, a lot of problems that went on for years, and you know, there was domestic violence and rebellion, and it's sort of it's really a tragedy. And in my book, I talk about what was really going on at the time of Kennedy's assassination and what was changed. And there are some fascinating phone conversations between Johnson and Richard Russell, who was a senator from Georgia and a foreign policy expert and a member of the Warren Commission. And in spring of 64, I think it was April and June of 64, Johnson's on the telephone with Russell saying, I don't know what to do about Vietnam, it's such a mess. And Russell predicted accurately that if we got heavily involved in there, we'd be fighting a war for 10 years and we'd lose 50,000 men, which is just about what happened, and we wouldn't win. And Johnson says, I know, I realize it, but I can't stop it, basically. And you know, what happened was the people who put him in power, that was the price he paid, was to widen the war, because it was good for big business, you know, the military-industrial complex. But it's a tragedy, because he was fully aware that the war was futile, and it destroyed him and his presidency. And he was forced to resign in 68, or to not run again, actually, by his wise men, who were a group of senior advisors, basically ordered him to stand down. And he called it my assassination, a very little-known fact. He told the reporter for the Times of London, he said it was his assassination. He said it was more painful than Kennedy's, because I had to live on afterwards. He was being forced out of office. So it really destroyed his presidency, but he did do some good domestic things. But, you know, the lying to the public about the Vietnam War, a lot of this book is about lying. I started with a quote from Tennessee Williams, Canada Hutch, and Roof, where Big Daddy says, you know, the odor of mendacity, he talks about there's nothing worse than mendacity. And they lied about the Vietnam War, which disillusioned the public. And, you know, there was a time when I was young and around 1960, we still trusted the government and we still believed the president. That's when Eisenhower shocked us by lying about the U-2 flights. And, I mean, presidents have lied for...
Minor interruption there with Professor McBride. What I may have to do is reach back and call him. So I think that's what I'm going to do. And you guys stick around, keep listening, because this is rather fascinating. On the Ocelli Effect, a special broadcast. Hold on. Okay, so I've got Professor McBride to rejoin us, and he was just discussing the deception over the U-2 flights, which was perpetrated by President Eisenhower, which may have been for a good reason, but anyway, that's the point in the story we were at when technology interfered. Yeah. So go ahead.
Well, Eisenhower was caught in that lie because he thought the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, had been killed, but he survived, and the Russians made a big propaganda deal out of it. And we tended to believe the government then, and then we started being shaken by the Kennedy assassination. People started not believing the government because a majority of the public soon after the assassination thought it was a conspiracy, and that went on until the Warren Commission report in the fall of 64, which was full of lies and distortions, sort of changed the public view for a while. But then the public began to respond to dissident writers such as Mark Lane and Sylvia Marr and other writers, Edward J. Epstein, who did dissenting books on the case. And the tide turned by 66. There was a lot of doubt about the assassination and has been ever since. And The Gallup polls have shown consistently over the years 60 or 70% of the public doesn't believe the single assassin theory, the lone assassin theory that the Warren Commission put out. But that, I think, has really damaged public trust in the government. Ironically, Clarence Thomas just the other day said, oh, it's terrible, the public doesn't have respect for institutions anymore. Well, he's a big part of that, but it started with the Kennedy assassination. Then the Vietnam War came along, and that's where people usually attribute the problem to that. And then,
well, let me lay out a key piece of context here, because to me this is a generational affair. A guy like Clarence Thomas might still think that somehow there is belief in the government, but you see, I was born in 1972, okay, and during the Nixon years, I'm 50 years old, so my father taught me how to read newspapers around the time I was three, so I started reading newspapers in 1975, all right? Mm-hmm. Trust in the government was not something that I even imagined, because...
Yeah, well, Nixon pretty much, you know, I mean, he lied all the time, and
well, there was him.
Today
plus...
we're shocked when the president doesn't lie.
Exactly.
Biden is more...
Well, see, that's exactly the thing, and that's why I want to go to the title immediately of this book and set you off on this path, if you don't mind. Because to me, the concept of political truth is literally an oxymoron or a fully loaded statement, one or the other, because political and truth, it's like oil and water in my mind. Again,
right.
You know, they were still discussing Watergate in the newspapers in 75. We then saw the removal of troops from Vietnam in 76. This is how I got introduced to the world of politics. And then by the end of the 70s, I'm reading about the House Select Committee and the other committees, which had exposed, you know, misdeeds by government agencies. And not a lot, but just enough coverage to let me know that this was actually the norm. This was not the exception. That,
right.
You know, that lies and the politicians, this was guaranteed. I mean, Jimmy Carter was a good guy. He's the first president I really remember trying to, you know, listen to when he spoke and all that. But I put an asterisk next to him as the politician that tried not to lie. But
yeah.
But other than that, I accepted that when Reagan came along, he was a liar. When everybody else came along, it was a guarantee. It wasn't a question of whether they were going to lie to me or not. It was a question of how much. And that's all there was to it. So political truth is almost an insane title to me. I'm not saying that you're insane for putting it there. I get why it's there. But the idea to me that political truth is even something that is, you know, exists more in the world than unicorns do is scary. Okay, so that's a loaded statement. Why did you begin with that, or why is that the title? One, two.
Well,
why did you write this book? Why did you choose this to write about? I mean, is there a relevance to something that, you know, encouraged you to do it today at this time? Because you could have written this book in many previous decades, and it might have looked a little different. So I'm just curious if there is a reason that you wrote this at this time, why you chose the title, and could you explain what the full motivation was that, you know, let me add yet another book. I mean, I'm sorry to say this, but let me add yet another book to the literature. And quite frankly, I always ask the question when somebody tells me they're writing a book, I say, are you going to add something? Because there is a mountain of nonsense. There is a mountain of good stuff. But are you going to add something here, or are you going to echo something? Now, I know you added something here, and we'll get into that later. But it's very difficult when you have this massive, voluminous pile of literature. If you visualize it physically, which, you know, most people get digital books now. But if you visualize it physically, you got a library of stuff already. And so it's almost odd to me. I'm sorry. There's a library of stuff that exists already. So I'm wondering why it is you chose to add to it. Why you chose the title. Oh, and there he actually goes. He didn't hear me. I'll be right back. And one more interruption, but we're back. Joseph McBride, we'll get through this one way or another, sir.
Yeah, all right. We lost the connection a couple times. Well, anyway, the title comes from Edward G. Epstein's book, Inquest, which was a very important book in the case, 1966. He exposed the mendacity and the slippery behavior of the Warren Commission. He had access to a lot of staff members and commissioners, very important research, and he kind of accepted the view of the Warren Commission in an odd way because it was expedient for the times, and if we had known the whole truth of the assassination in 63 or 64, there could have been some kind of revolt. It would have shaken the government considerably. But Epstein said, well, what they found was a form of political truth. In mm-hmm. other words, there's a kind of truth that isn't really a truth, but it's an expedient truth. And that's what I think I wanted to discuss, because the mainstream media have been doing that ever since. They've been feeding us a palatable version of the assassination that isn't as disturbing as it would be to say, yeah, there was a conspiracy and we didn't catch the people involved and we prosecuted the wrong guy and then he was lynched in a police station, but he was innocent. And that's what I believe. And so what I do in the book is I study the mainstream media, which are almost always, with some exceptions and some variations, in favor of the Warren Commission version, which is absurd when you get into it. And the House Select Committee in 1979 put out a report saying there were two gunmen, one from the Grassy Knoll and one from the Texas School Book Depository, but they didn't identify the Grassy Knoll shooter, and they blamed Oswald for the shooting from behind. And the press wouldn't accept that. And the height of absurdity, the most bizarre conspiracy theory in the case, I say, is the Washington Post and the New York Times, who are both leading culprits in lying about the case, actually tried to rationalize the HSC finding by saying there were two lone gunmen who showed up at the exact same time but had nothing to do with each other and fired at the same moment, which is totally absurd, of course. I call that the two lone nuts theory, but they, you know, they were apparently acting alone, the two newspapers. But you know, then I contrast all of those lies from the mainstream media with the alternate media, such as shows like yours, Chuck, and you know, a lot of podcasts, a lot of internet sites, and alternative documentaries and films and books. Books are more free in America than the press. So if you want the truth, you don't go to the New York Times on this subject, or the Washington Post or other outlets like that. You go to a lot of books that have come out. They don't get as much publicity or money behind them or major publishers behind them as the pro-Warren Commission books, such as Daryl Posner's Case Closed, for example, got tremendous promotion because it just supported the Warren Commission version. But there are a lot of good books. And then, as you say, there are a lot of mediocre books that sort of rehash things that other people have written. But quite a number of books have broken new ground, such as David Lifton's Best Evidence and books by historian Peter Dale Scott and Sylvia Marr's Accessories After the Fact. Those are a few of the really good ones. And they keep coming out. People keep, you know, independent amateur investigators have done the work that the police and the FBI and the mainstream media have failed to do. They haven't really investigated the case properly. But people like me and other people go around and interview witnesses who are neglected, or, you know, we reapproach them and get revelations out of them. I interviewed Henry Wade, the DA of Dallas County, for Into the Nightmare, and Jim Lavelle, the head detective on the Tippit case, and both of them indicated to me that Captain Will Fritz, the head of homicide at the Dallas Police Department, told them the night of the assassination, "We don't have a very good case on Oswald for killing Kennedy. We better get him on killing Tippit." And there wasn't much of a case there either. The evidence is very contradictory. I don't think Oswald killed Tippit either, but he was only arraigned for the Tippit killing, not for the presidential assassination. He was charged for both, but most people don't know that. And the police and the DA had a lot of doubts that weekend. That they occasionally shared on television with the public, but then by the end of the weekend, the cover story was solidifying. And on the Monday of the funeral, Nicholas Katzenbach, who was Deputy Attorney General running that department in Robert Kennedy's temporary absence, put out an infamous memo that we have to find quickly, that Oswald did it alone, and you know, the facts seem inflammatory, you know, that he spent time in Russia and has a Russian wife, et cetera, and he had connections with Cuba, allegedly, although those have been fabricated. And anyway, he said, "We have to wrap it up." I mean, this is like right after the assassination. J. Edgar Hoover, about 4:01 p.m. on the day of the assassination, said, "We've got it solved. We have our man," which is absurd. You couldn't investigate a case like that seriously that fast. But they did claim to wrap it up. And so I studied what was really going on behind the scenes and then how the media reported in two ways. And I believe that this dual track has helped lead to our current state. And you asked why I wrote the book at this time. It's a sort of complicated answer, but I deal a lot with the January 6th attack on the Capitol, which was a failed coup by Trump. But people said, well, we've never really had a coup in America until this time. And the press, again, most of them tried to deny it was a coup attempt. They were using words like insurrection and riot, and you know, they kept downgrading it, and I thought eventually they'll call it a tailgate party that got out of hand. But when General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was talking about how he was trying to prevent the government from being overthrown, the word coup started being used again in the mainstream media. So you do hear it from time to time, but it's usually called an insurrection, which is bad enough, but it was a coup attempt. But people thought we never had one before. We had one in '63, a successful coup d'etat, And people don't want to admit that because it's threatening to our system. We're supposed to be a democratic country. We don't have oligarchs and strongmen, to use words that they use for other countries. But getting to how I wrote this and why I wrote this, I actually started writing about the Kennedy assassination in October 1961, 2 years before it happened. I wrote a short story about his assassination for freshman English class at Marquette University High School in Milwaukee, called The Plot Against the Country, and it's kind of a juvenile piece, but I did discuss some aspects that were knowledgeable, such as the autopsy and the murder methods and how they infiltrated the White House, etc. And the reason I wrote that, I was a volunteer for John F. Kennedy in 1960 in his Wisconsin presidential primary campaign, and I got to meet him twice up close, and I was struck by his lack of security. He was at one event. He came in, there were about 100 or 200 kids and their mothers, and Kennedy came in with a reporter and a couple of aides, and that was about it, no security, and we all mingled with him and chatted with him, and I had a talk with him about profiles and courage. And then two days later, I met him again at a huge rally in Milwaukee that's the centerpiece of the documentary Primary, where there were 3,000 people, and he was shaking hands and signing autographs, and I was right next to him. Right. And the only visible security, there was a policeman standing, you know, a little ways away, but not very close. But he was very vulnerable, and I was already a student of the Civil War and the Lincoln assassination. I was concerned about his security, and I did a thing that it was rather gauche. I stuck my Brownie camera 3 feet from his face and blew off a flashbulb and it exploded in his face and got a close-up that was out of focus, and he winced, and I felt immediately embarrassed, and then he broke into a smile, you know, very, very smooth political smile, and but I realized then how vulnerable he was, so I wrote this piece. And then when he was shot, I heard this from a student in the cafeteria line at high school, and I ran to a radio because I instinctively knew that when something terrible happens, you should get to the radio or television as quickly as possible, because a lot of the first reports are actually accurate before they start changing the story. And from 12:40 to 1 o'clock, 10 minutes after the assassination, I started listening at 12:40. They said the shots came from the front, from either this hill or the railroad yard, or the railroad overpass. And then at 1 o'clock, they started saying all the shots came from behind, from a building called the Texas School Book Depository. And they didn't explain why the change of direction. They stopped talking about the shots from the front. So I kind of smelled a rat, because I was already a reporter. The first article I ever sold to a magazine was May of 1960. In the same week, I got a letter from Kennedy thanking me for my help in the campaign. And and my parents were newspaper people. So when they change stories without explaining it, it sends up a red flag in my mind. So I became very interested. By the end of the day, I didn't believe the official story, and I heard Oswald say he was just a patsy, and I believed him. And he seemed credible, and, you know, a lot of loose ends. I was swayed by the Warren Report, but then I started getting back into it in 66 when these dissenting books came out. So I was a part-time student of the case for a while, but in 1982 I got seriously involved. I thought I would start doing a book on it. My own investigation, I went to Dallas for the first time. I made several visits there, and it took me 31 years to write Into the Nightmare, which is a big book on the Tippit case, which has been neglected. And I broke new ground on the Tippit case. I showed that he was sent out with another officer named William Menzel to track down Oswald in Oak Cliff. This is before the police department officially knew who Oswald was, and they were sent to either capture or kill him. We don't know for sure, but probably to kill him. And Tippit drove into a police ambush, and all these police cars then descended into Oak Cliff. And I go through this. It's a very complicated case, and I also talk about the Kennedy case and revelations that I came up with, and people involved, and you know, it's very interesting. I found out that more people were involved than I realized, including some of the mainstream media were involved before the fact. For example, one of the most interesting things, Dan Rather, famous CBS correspondent who left CBS under a cloud, he was a correspondent from New Orleans, but he had worked in Dallas. Yeah. And he was there, and he's given various reports of where he was when the shots were fired, which is strange. But he was reporting on the case live from 1 o'clock on that it was the shots were fired from behind. And then he was one of the first people to see the Zapruder film, and he reported on it on television. And we weren't allowed to see the film because Time Life hid it away, and Rather gave what seemed like a distorted view of the shooting, but he may have been describing an earlier version of the film, which we've now found out was altered that weekend to remove evidence of the car coming to a stop or a near stop, and the turn on Elm Street was removed, and the headshots were altered in the film, and Rather may have seen an uncut version. But anyway, in Dallas, he convinced CBS to send 5 camera crews to cover the president. And usually each of the 3 major networks had 1 crew with the president on a trip, you know, a camera crew and a reporter. And he had 5 full crews, including the only live hookup, which was at the Trademark, where Kennedy was going to speak. And so why did he do that? And he said he was, you know, sensing that something might happen, and, you know, it's very suspicious. And so that's an example of the media having some kind of possible advanced knowledge. And Time Incorporated, Time Life, was another one of the major cover-up artists. And they helped support a financially supportive mission into Cuba to sabotage Castro. Claire Booth Luce, the wife of Henry Luce, the publisher of Time and Life, was involved in that. And then they bought the... she was also calling around the day of the assassination to link Oswald to Cuba. It seemed like Peter Dale Scott says the plan one was to send, was to make Oswald seem like he was an agent of either Castro or the Russians to provoke an attack on Cuba. The lone gunman theory was phase two, according to Scott, that Johnson felt that, you know, it was too risky to risk a nuclear war by invading Cuba, so or punishing Russia. So they came up with this lone gunman theory, which took a few days to solidify. Mm. But they really tried and convicted him on television, too, and that's one of the really bad things that happens in our country, and I was first aware of that at the time. So I go into all the ways they manipulated the public, and then I connected with January 6th because...
Well, before you go to January 6th, which I want to get to, I got to ask you a question, which is something that I've found interesting over the years with the radio coverage of the time. Over that weekend, immediately following the assassination, the speed at which the networks were able to distribute among themselves excerpts of the interviews of Oswald from New Orleans. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
This is very unusual to me because I'm aware that they used to literally have to physically, you know, fly tapes to places, right?
Yeah.
You didn't have the internet, obviously. You didn't have, you know, the ease of various types of communication. You even see in the archival footage of, like, NBC trying to cover the assassination. They don't know how to put a phone call on the air. They don't know how to do a lot of stuff. But one thing that distributed very quickly among radio stations was these 2 interviews, the WDSU interview and also the Latin Listening Post interview, right? Which today are easily accessible and all that. But honestly, they had been conducted over the summer in New Orleans. They had statements on them to show Oswald the commie, you know, basically saying, no, I'm not a communist, but I'm a Marxist-Leninist. And he does a poor... job of trying to explain that. But the point is that I found it remarkable that in radio coverage from Cincinnati, from Cleveland, from New York, from California, all over the country, it seemed like they instantaneously almost had these excerpts. Now, I could see how information would come across a wire. You know, they used to have these teletypes and things like this, and they could have sent whole written bios out of Oswald, but audio was a different story back then. Indeed, you know, Cronkite comes on and takes over not only the broadcast for CBS nationwide, and they keep checking in with our man in Dallas, Dan Rather, yes. But also, that's on the radio, but the radio stations, which didn't really have the capacity to move around this audio very quickly without some foreknowledge, instantly seemed to have access to it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, the whole New Orleans episode, Oswald was there during the summer, and it seemed that he was being set up for what they call a legend, which is a false identity of, you know, as a certain kind of person, in his case a communist. And he gave interviews to radio and TV, and the TV interview also wound up very quickly on network television clips of that, and those were very effective in trying to portray him as a communist, and I believe he was a false defector to Russia. He was working for the CIA, and he was not a communist. As you say, he said he was a Marxist-Leninist, but he was also a patriotic American who was working for the CIA and the FBI. But they got these documents very quickly to the media, who then distributed it. And also, by the end of that day, there was a very extensive print biography of him with all kinds of damaging information that was false and some was true. But they put out a ream of material. It's like on 9/11, by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they put out the names of the 19 alleged hijackers. Mm-hmm. And how did they get it that quickly? I mean, you know, we found out later that the FBI had somebody living with two of the alleged hijackers. I don't believe they actually did it, but you know, all this stuff came out very quickly, and that's rather suspicious, quite suspicious. And that's an example of the media and the government collaborating. They were, you know, working closely together. Carl Bernstein wrote a famous article you can find online in 1977 for Rolling Stone about the CIA's infiltration of the media, and he said there were about 400 members of the press who had been working for the CIA in one capacity or another, either full-time undercover or just supplying information or printing stories they wanted printed, 400 over the last 25 years, he said. And the main culprits were the New York Times, CBS, and Time Life. He was rather careful about his own previous outlet, the Washington Post, which is virtually a CIA front. But, you know, the CIA was very tight with the press, who some of them thought it was their patriotic duty to cooperate with the government. A lot of them were people from the World War II generation who were used to censorship and cooperating with the government. But, you know, the government and the media were, you know, inextricable, and it still continues today to some extent, even though they claim to have cleaned it up. But the propaganda against Oswald was overwhelming, but the public, to their credit, still didn't totally believe it. They smelled a rat, you know. But it's a drumbeat that you keep reading a lot of these stories, and I was going to mention January 6th that I believe that this led directly to the world we live in today is a world of two realities. Half the public believes one version of history and half believe a false version, and you see the effects that came together on the attack on January 6th and then the way the press covered it. They've done a spotty job. Some have done a good job and some not so good, but you know, it's not, people don't have a lot of historical perspective on how this we had a coup in 1963, and then, you know, when you have illegitimate governments, it causes all kinds of ripple effects, and we had a stolen election in 2000, and we had Iran-Contra, and we have all these crises that seem inexplicable. And one thing I found is all the major events in American history since 1960, the official story doesn't hold up at all if you start looking into it, starting with the U-2 case and then Kennedy assassination, Vietnam, Watergate, Iran-Contra, the first Gulf War, the other two wars, 9/11, all the official stories are absurd, really, if you study them. And the Warren Report had only a handful of so-called proofs that Oswald did it, and they collapse very quickly when you start comparing them with documents and witness reports, etc. You don't read that in the New York Times or the Washington Post, and they purport to be, you know, the leading newspapers, and it's very damaging. No wonder the public is confused, and they get confused by demagogues like Trump, but they also get confused by the press, which is supposed to be a watchdog. And Mark Lane, who was one of the first important critics of the official story, maybe the first, he said in 2013 that the honor of France was restored when they admitted that Captain Dreyfus was innocent, but the honor of the United States will not be restored until the government admits that Oswald was innocent. And I'm not holding my breath for that to happen. A lot of people still think he did it. I read this even today in some, I saw it in some video on YouTube. Somebody did some piece on Kennedy's body, and it was just full of mistakes. And a lot of people are very naive, and they don't read thoroughly on the case. But what I did was, from 82 onward, I've been studying the case. I study it every day, and I read all the books, I read all the articles, and I wrote my big book on it, which came out in 2013, and I was thinking of doing a chapter on the media and the assassination along the lines that we've been talking about, but I kept thinking it's too big a topic for a chapter. I did a chapter on the TV coverage that weekend, which was hailed as the first time the medium came of age and became mature, but in fact I think they did a terrible job, and it was like a docudrama, you know, starting with a shocking murder. And then they basically solve the case with the suspect over the next couple days, and then he's killed on television, executed on TV, which is like a cathartic event, supposedly. And then they have the grand funeral on the Monday, which is very beautifully produced, but it sort of anesthetized the public with the cooperation of Jackie Kennedy. However, she and Robert Kennedy sent a message to Moscow with William Walton, who is an emissary friend of theirs, who was going there for an arts conference, and he sent a message to the Kremlin through a contact they had that the Kennedys didn't believe that one man killed the president. They thought maybe Oswald was involved, but it was a conspiracy, and it was basically a right-wing conspiracy, and they said, we want you to know we don't blame the Russians or the Cubans. And this was their private thing. I wish they had gone public with it. And a lot of people, including Johnson and, you know, many people in the government, didn't really believe it was a lone gunman, but they went along with that story because to question this is seen by the media as shaking up the legitimacy of our government, and they exist to kind of prop up the status quo and cheerlead for the government. And it has bad effects when you constantly lie to people and they can see through it, because they don't respect anything.
Yeah, and I hate to sound like a lone nut theorist here, but quite honestly, somebody could argue that it was politically expedient, because if you were not able to prevent the assassination, what assurances could you give to the people? In that way, I could see a cover-up being sold to some people as, well, good, you know, your patriotic duty. Because no matter what the situation is, it is best that the people think we have everything under control. Which is fascinating to me for something that I'm going to go outside of the genre a bit. Because I recently reread Aldous Huxley's Brave New World Revisited. And it does remind me that when I combine Orwell's work, and not just 1984, but some of his other work, along with Huxley's work, not just Brave New World, but key things in the canon, so to speak, you know, you can see how there has been a divergence here, which goes beyond the arguments that used to be. And I think this is the bridge between, well, the disenchantment with the government, the understanding that you were being lied to, the understanding that there might have been a cover-up, and this now different sort of thing that has emerged currently. And I wonder what you think of it, because to me, it seems as though we live in an age now where, well, it's not a matter of you and I arguing over the facts, the minutiae, the ultimate conclusions. No, now there is an argument over whether anything actually happened. Is it real at all? Some people out there, you know, dealing with the everything is fake. You know,
news is fake. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, there are a number of things. Huxley, who died the same day JFK died, oddly enough.
Right.
His books, A Brave New World and Revisited and 1984 by Orwell, are virtual textbooks for understanding the world today.
Right.
And how truths have become lies, and they palliate the public with creature comforts and drugs and things like that.
Right.
And but you know, if you study 1984, it's all about destroying the truth and claiming things didn't happen. It's creating fake news. And but you know, who's more responsible for fake news? I'd say the New York Times is the number one suspect. They've been lying about this case from the beginning. And Trump started, you know, attacking the media for fake news, but he has a different meaning for it. It's people who don't agree with him, but
right.
the media don't have clean hands in this matter. But the rationalization, a lot of the media did think they were being patriotic in those days, and some were very cynical, but they thought it was better for the public. Peggy Noonan said many years later that maybe we were lucky that we didn't know the truth at the time, because it would have shaken the government. Well, I think it's more important for people to know the truth and that they can act on it. But the public was confused and pacified, even though they had serious doubts. But so it's not really benign cover-up, as some people call it. It was had seriously damaging effects in our country, and I go into great detail on why that would be. I started thinking about this book and taking notes for it in the 90s when I was doing Into the Nightmare. You know, I decided not to write a chapter on the whole media thing. I think it was too complicated, but I did a lot of note-taking on it, and I tried selling that book to a mainstream publisher in the 90s, and mainstream publishers generally hardly ever accept books that are questioning the Warren Report. And this is, you know, a long time ago, and some documents are still withheld, et cetera. And it shows you how important the case is. So you either have to get it published by a smaller publisher, or in my case, self-publish both books. You can do that now, and that's really great for dissident authors or people who have books that are controversial or things that the mainstream won't pick up. I sell my books, Into the Nightmare and Political Truth, The Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy, on Amazon through a fulfillment house, and they print it on demand and get it to people, and it's great. You know, it's a very democratization of book publishing, which really helps spread the word. And, of course, there are a lot of books that inundate the media, and you have to get the word out so people can sort out which books they think are worth reading and which aren't. But it's really terrific that we have that outlet as long as it exists. And the Internet and radio, you know, radio shows and podcasts, which are kind of a form of radio connected with the Internet, are extremely valuable because you get to talk at length on subjects in a mainstream media. Cuts everything down to short sound bites and oversimplifies things, but they don't allow a lot of assassination critics on the air. You know, if you write a book supporting the assassination theory of the Warren Commission, you get on the air and you get a lot of coverage. But it's a sad situation, which I think the only solution to these problems we're in is just you know, as they say, the solution to lies is ventilation, more sunlight, more truth, fewer lies, and get the word out to the public. But I don't see any progress with the New York Times or Washington Post on this subject at all.
Well,
but
no.
Fortunately, we have a lot of alternate people like you and other people, right. and authors, you know.
Right. No, and that's the great thing about this time. You know, it's treacherous because there is a great deal of still, you know, there will be people that will be misled and will put out disinformation and misinformation, you know, with good faith, because they don't have, you know, the time or the ability to really research a lot of things, and they will find what they think is a good idea somewhere and run with it. And sometimes that happens to be the government narrative or a narrative that is so ridiculous as to undermine even the very concept of questioning the official narrative, which, you know, makes it difficult. But at the same time, the freedom to do that. Look, these things will stand up or not based on people trying to verify them and bolster them themselves with their own research. And I always encourage people, listen, don't even take my opinion or my analysis to be the only answer to the question. Always look again and analyze these things for yourself as you see fit. We're about to go to a break. So before we do, you know, I just again want to mention that, yes, indeed, your books are available on Amazon, and you've written about a great many other subjects. If you want, mention some of those also. But today's discussion is about political truth, the media, and the assassination of President Kennedy, which is a substantial book by author Joseph McBride. He's written many other things. I actually want to talk to him about a very interesting piece of has nothing to do with the assassination, has nothing to do with any of that, something called the broken places, and we're going to discuss that at some point, not today, but I want to give another hour to this because I want you to break down some more of what goes on. We barely scratched what's in the book, but is there another place they can go to see your books outside of Amazon, or you have a website that you'd like to tell people about? Please do.
Well, I have I had a personal website, and I was so busy. I had four books that came out since October. I failed to renew it. I'm sorry. I got to do a new one. But I have websites on The Broken Places, Into the Nightmare, and my book on Ernst Lubitsch, the director, How Did Lubitsch Do It? And I have a new book, Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, which is a very ambitious, long study of his career. And I have a book on Orson Welles, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, Portrait of an Independent Career. And then I have a book on the Coen brothers that just came out called The Whole Durn Human Comedy, Life According to the Coen Brothers. And so I've got a lot of books. I have biographies of John Ford, Steven Spielberg, and Frank Capra, which were very ambitious. And I wrote a book about how I struggled for 4 years with a legal battle to get the Capra book out. It was called Frankly Unmasking Frank Capra. Thank you for having me on and talking about the Kennedy books. I'm glad you like The Broken Places. That's my memoir of my troubled youth, and that took 49 years to write. Some of these projects germinate for a long time, and you know, I'm writing books. Sometimes I work on more than one at the same time, but the Kennedy stuff has been going on since 1982, which is, you know, like 40 years from now already, and I'll keep studying it for the rest of my life. It becomes a lifelong study, but this is my, I think my main interest in life is the Kennedy assassination. It had a profound effect on me, as it did on so many people. It changed my whole career path. I was going to be a lawyer and politician, then I lost faith in the governmental system, and I decided to be a writer of films and books, and I find that much more satisfying. And also, when you do these self-published books, you're completely free of any interference by publishers or anybody else. And so I write exactly the books I want, and that's why I'm so happy with these two books, and I'm glad people find them a good, fascinating connection. I really try to expose a lot of new information, and you know, I've read a tremendous wealth of material and seen many films on the assassination, so I synthesize these, and there have been a few books on that subject, but none written by a practicing journalist, and I think that my history as a journalist informs that, because it's a critique of the media, and I've been a media critic for a long time, and when I teach students, it's kind of what you said, you teach them to be critical students of the media. Read a lot of sources. Don't take your news from one source. Don't believe automatically what you read anywhere. But you know, synthesize it, and then try to read documents and books, and make up your own mind. I'm glad a lot of the American public do that. They're smarter than the politicians, so that's a hopeful sign.
Well, and I'm hoping for much more deconstruction because, you know, quite often when I've given a couple of presentations, not as many as you, but I mean, I've been invited to do this on the media and JFK. And one of the best parts of any of my presentations is always, okay, consider this for a moment. In order to put together this piece of film where you see these things happening, what did that take to assemble it? Because a lot of times when you consider not just the presentation and the alleged facts within, but also consider how it is they came about, how it is they discovered this, how it is, you know, if you sort of, again, reverse engineer how that presentation came together, quite often it'll leave you with some startling open questions. And
I do that in this book, Chuck. I start really how the myth was formed. You know, I really go into that, and then what was happening at the same time we didn't know about, but while they were creating the myth, and then I go into how the myth has been perpetuated and locked into stone all these years, and then challenged by dissidents. So, but studying how the myth is created is really fascinating.
Absolutely.
Piece by piece, and then the film, like the history of the Zapruder film, and you know, most of the, a lot of the documentation and evidence in this case has either been lost, destroyed, or altered, and that creates many problems for researchers too. And so you have to really study the provenance of all the documents and evidence. That's an important fact in the research too.
Yes, and after this short break, I'd actually like to talk to you about some of the evidence which has emerged since your initial interest, because there has actually been new evidence and partially revisited evidence which has come out to the public's attention despite the best efforts of various government agencies to make sure that we don't see it, in addition to other things. And maybe we'll get into all that after this break. Author Joseph McBride, Political Truth and Political Truth, the Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy.
Gold, silver, the stock market, WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right, well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now, has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com, enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Every time I put it on my face, I'm able to breathe just a little bit deeper. What are people saying about mytrueessence.net?
I'm going to tell you something serious, man. I just want to tell you listeners, I bought some of that Modifilin from Christy, and she made me up some of this emu oil mixed with some other stuff. I don't know what's in it, but I like the way it smelled. And I started putting it on, rubbing it on my foot, rubbing it on my knee, and like the second day, I just noticed it. I'm walking around, I'm like, damn, my knee is loose.
I can tell you that oil you gave me helped me with my carpal and my shoulder problem. And if it wasn't, I wouldn't be working.
My ankles are just really, really pesky and bother me. And I'm telling you, the pain just went away. Essential oils rule!
And when I put that on, it's like my skin came alive.
MyTrueEssence.net.
In denial. Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools?
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before, that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War
by author Mike Swanson.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Author, scholar, student of the Kennedy assassination, all of these things apply to Joseph McBride, who was the author of Political Truth, The Media, and the Assassination of President Kennedy. Now, that happens to be the topic of discussion today, but he's written a great many other books on many fascinating topics, which relate to, well, let's see, the assassination again, politics in general, maybe various other social issues that we could get into. But the media is definitely a common thread through most of his work. I'm not sure if The Broken Places has a media feature in it. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I will say that that is a fascinating personal memoir. We will visit that on a show in the future, and maybe some of these other things, Billy Wilder, Orson Welles. I mean, you know, I don't know if I'll get into the Coen brothers with you. I don't know if we'll go there, but we'll probably get to everything else. Joseph McBride, again, taking a second hour with us today, and I want to get deeper into the rest of the story, you know, like Paul Harvey used to say. Because there's a lot here when it comes to the media, political truth in and of itself, which we tried to tackle in the first hour a bit. Like I said, either a loaded statement or an oxymoron, depending on how you come at it. And again, I'm not trying to insult your book title, Professor McBride. I'm just saying that I have never had the idea in my mind that political truth, you know, like I said, might as well be a unicorn to me. Doesn't really exist. When politics enters, truth leaves. When truth enters, politics get real quiet. It just seems like to me that's the reality. But then again, we also had to discuss the other unreality, so to speak, when it comes to, well, what actually exists. Maybe we're not going to have arguments about the facts, but now we're going to argue whether something even happened at all because everything's fake and fake news. And that's kind of where we left off again, only briefly touching on the January 6th thing. But I promise you, I'm going to let him run with that if he's got more to say, because I think this is extremely relevant. I agree with him that we suffered a coup in November of 1963. I believe that there have been a couple of other attempted coups in between then and January 6th. But then again, I'm not sure whose side is, you know, whose side anybody's on anymore, because, well, the dishonesty is the only thing that I can depend on, seemingly, when it comes to the media, when it comes to the politicians, when it comes to the historians. So let's see what else we can set straight with Joseph McBride. Where did you want to go next, sir? Uh-oh. Did I talk too long and put him to sleep? No, I didn't do that. What I did somehow is maybe I've lost audio, so I'm going to just call him right on back here in just a second and have you guys, I guess, let's see, what are we going to do? All right, we'll put this on, and yeah, I'll just call Joseph McBride back and let him pick up where he wants to. You guys stick around. So despite the conspiracy of technology working against me today,
yeah, right.
There's a joke. Joseph McBride, political truth, once again, yeah, we need to address, look, repetition is necessary. I know it may be boring to you, but I think the point needs to be made again about political truth in and of itself. So yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, political truth was a phrase from Edward J. Epstein's book Inquest, 1966, one of the first good books deconstructing the Warren Report. He interviewed a lot of people who worked on the Warren Commission and exposed their corner cutting and lies and reliance on false reports and over reliance on the FBI, etc. And he concluded that they reached a form of political truth which was not the real truth. And he was being critical up to a point, but he also seemed to kind of accept that. And later Epstein morphed into a pro Warren Commission person by writing a book on Oswald as the killer, etc. And people wondered if he had been co-opted or had some kind of change of heart or whatever. But it seemed like you can find clues even in Inquest. And Political Truth is an ironic title for my book because, as you say, it's a false it implies falsity and expediency. And sometimes they put out stories, they think that, you know, some people thought they were being patriotic or whatever to cover up, you know, things that would really shake the government. But it's not, to me, the public should be told the real truth about what's happening, whether it was Vietnam or Watergate or Iran-Contra or whatever, or things today. And if we get fed lies and fake news, as it's called now, which we get from the New York Times as much as from any, you know, any right-wing source, it is just causing all kinds of social problems, and dissent comes out of that, and then people start questioning the government and undermining the government, which is a good thing in a way, although it can be a bad thing, as you can see in the attack on January 6th, where people think the government is the enemy. But, you know, this traces back partly to the assassination and the schism that went on at the time, but that the media are in bed with the government, and they think of themselves as a kind of a branch of the government, the mainstream media, and they do their bidding. And a lot of them, I think, privately know that the truth is different from what they report. But they, it's considered very dangerous for your career to dissent from the Warren version or the official version of, say, 9/11. If you do that, you lose your job in the mainstream media. And I talked to Jim Hogan, who wrote a dissenting book on Watergate called Secret Agenda, a very good book, very different view of Watergate. And he said it would be career suicide, professional suicide, to write on the Kennedy case, and he won't do it. So here's a good investigative journalist who's afraid of it, but I just go ahead and do it.
Quick pause there, though. Jim Hogan's book on Watergate is one of the most profoundly interesting books I ever read on Watergate, which is due to him getting a hold of some documentation that maybe some other people had not gotten a hold of previously, to my understanding. So
it's also a good book called Silent Coup by Kolodny and I think Getlin was his collaborator, and those two books really tell you a whole different story of Watergate from this more accurate from the fairy tale version of All the President's Men.
Right, and you know, even strangely, just to divert for a moment, strangely, I would say that even though G. Gordon Liddy, who was a person of interest there, is not exactly the most likable character in the world, or wasn't anyway. I got to speak to him once. He had some interesting things to say about that circumstance that, again, I wouldn't take any of it as gospel, but I would take it as a reasonable challenge, considering that he was there. And there's a lot to be said about that. And again, this, and I often say, by the way, that, you know, Nixon challenged the CIA as well. And quite frankly, I think it was too soon to put a bullet in another president's head.
They were, you know, it was a bloodless coup, except actually, now I have to qualify that, because there was the Watergate plane crash. 94 people died. And it was apparently sabotaging the plane that Mrs. Howard Hunt was on. And she was carrying hush money to the burglars, and she was with a congresswoman, and the plane was brought down in Chicago. And so that's, you know, Watergate related. One of the best books on the Kennedy case, The Yankee and Cowboy War by Carl Oglesby, a terrific book. He connects Watergate and the JFK assassination. Many of the same players pop up in a lot of these cases. And the CIA really was plotting to overthrow Nixon. They had some severe turf battles with him and disagreements about detente, and Nixon didn't want to invade Cuba, and they wanted him to invade Cuba. And
that sounds familiar, doesn't it?
they ran the Watergate caper, and they were entrapping him, and they knew that he'd walk into the trap and commit illegal activities to cover it up, but he had nothing to do with the burglaries. There were more than one, and Hogan also connects it with a call girl ring that was operating out of the DNC. And John Dean's wife allegedly was friendly with the madam in the call girl ring. And some people think John Dean was helping to engineer Watergate, along with Bob Woodward, who was not just a humble reporter in the Washington Post. He was ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence, and he probably still is. And he spent a year secretly briefing Alexander Haig at the White House on the Navy's top secret intelligence. And he doesn't like to talk about that, and he won't admit that he's naval intelligence. But he was an intelligence officer who was channeling his sources, and there was no single person who was deep throat. That was a literary construct suggested by their editor, Alice Mayhew. It was not in the original manuscript, and they invented this character who is a composite of all of Woodward's intelligence sources that he didn't want to admit to. And so the story of Watergate is another plot. You know, it's a kind of a coup. It was a coup to overturn Nixon, and that's right. It worked. And so we had three presidents in a row who were basically forced out of office: Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon.
Right. Now, a fascinating thing here, just along the lines of the subject that we're talking today, is that, you know, the media's handling of Watergate was extremely different compared to the Kennedy assassination. You know, there was a controlled outlet of information with Watergate, where a lot of real information did get out. But with the Kennedy assassination, there was a very closed-door sort of policy. And it's interesting because the president in between, who literally says, look, I won't seek and I'm not going to run. Now, to my reading of things, he was also seeking to end the war in Vietnam and may have indeed been prevented from doing so before he left office by, guess who? The incoming president.
Well, it's partly true what you said. I don't think he was trying to end the war. I think he expanded it greatly, but he was realizing that the whole thing was a tragic morass.
Yeah.
And he wasn't trying to wind it down. Nixon ran with the vague promise to wind it down, and he didn't do it for years. But Johnson was the price he paid for being president. Put in office, and I think he's a person of interest, I guess you'd call him, in the Kennedy assassination. He had a lot of connections. That weekend of the assassination, he was under great pressure because Don Reynolds, an insurance man, was testifying before a Senate committee about how Johnson made him give him a bribe.
Right.
And the Bobby Baker case was erupting. Baker was Johnson's right-hand man and bagman. Johnson was deeply corrupt, and all that was going to come out in Life magazine the following Friday. They had a 8 or 10-man task force studying Johnson. They were meeting at the time of the assassination. The meeting broke up because of the assassination, but Don Reynolds kept testifying. They didn't tell him or the Senate people that Kennedy had been shot, and he kept testifying, gave them documentation about the bribes. So Johnson could have been forced off the ticket or sent to jail, very real possibility, by if he hadn't done something very quickly that week, and that weekend was critical. And so he had the means and the motive, and he was connected with a lot of the people involved in the Texas authorities, et cetera. And so that's another subject that should be studied more seriously. There are some books on Johnson, but they're not very good.
Right.
But
right.
For example, I'll just give you another example of the lies that come out in the media. Robert Caro, who's a great writer and historian, who's writing this biography of Johnson, which I really admire. He said in a speech some years ago that the battle between the Kennedys and Johnson was literally a blood feud, and I thought that meant that he was going to investigate the assassination.
Yeah. Didn't quite go that way, though. Yeah. Boy, oh boy, the technology continues to not cooperate. We'll be right back.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
Well,
5108830360.
Okay. Well, we'll just I don't know. I keep trying to call Professor McBride back, and we'll see if we can get him here. Calling him through my Skype number to see if I can connect him one more time to
Your
finish.
Your call has been forwarded
wow.
to an automatic voice message.
All right. Well, now I'm getting forwarded to an automatic voice messaging system. Anyway, it is what it is. Look, the discussion here about political truth, the media, and the assassination of President Kennedy with author Joseph McBride has been interrupted quite a bit. But I will say that there is a lot to cover here. I'm not sure if I necessarily agree with him being turning his attention to President Johnson as a person of interest. Although the whole story that he was telling you there with Don Reynolds and the testimony and the various scandals that were about to break on Johnson right then and there at the end of November 1963, Time Magazine and Life Magazine, I believe, had it was Life Magazine. Had a whole expose planned where they were going to release a whole bunch of information on various Johnson scandals. I mean, stuff ranging from insurance fraud to, cash payoffs and all kinds of things. But all of it got scuttled in the wake of the assassination. The media coverage, which was, again, fascinating. I mean, he says, I don't think that the medium of television came to age at that time. Came into its golden age, but it did go live for the first time, really, where a singular event captivated the whole of the national media, and not just for an hour or a short amount of time or a couple of reports over a couple of days, but they suspended every other type of programming, which was interesting in and of itself. So I would say that there was a great deal there to dig through if you're not aware of the media history. And I'm going to try and call Professor McBride one more time and see if we can't continue this discussion.
Hello.
Yes, we're back on the air already.
I heard.
Yeah. Sorry about it. It was going to voicemail when I called you back, by the way. So, so here we are. You were discussing all of the stuff that was going on there, the various scandals that were starting to blow up who would be President Johnson, but was still Vice President Johnson at the time. I mean, this ranges from insurance scams to cotton allotment payoffs to, cash payoffs that were showing up and all this stuff. Don Reynolds was given testimony on one thing, but there was a whole litany of scandals about to land in Johnson's lap. So that's where you were when you got cut off.
That weekend, Johnson was facing the Don Reynolds information, and Senator Yarborough told me he thought that's what was preoccupying Johnson during the motorcade. He said all through the motorcade he was very, very distant, very preoccupied, wasn't waving at the crowds. And Yarborough said, why don't you wave at these people? They're happy to see you. And he was very preoccupied. And the senator thought later Johnson must have been thinking about the Reynolds case. But Life Magazine's task force studying Johnson's criminal financial record in conjunction with the Bobby Baker case was planning. They had a meeting going on at the time of the assassination. They were going to run a story probably the next Friday, but that was stopped by the assassination. They ran one about a year later that wasn't as strong, but Johnson did everything possible once he became president to quash the Baker case, even though some of the Republicans kept it going. But he was in danger of being thrown off the ticket or going to jail. And I was mentioning, I don't know if listeners heard me talk about the Secret Serviceman Rufus Youngblood or whether I got cut off there.
Yeah, we didn't hear about Rufus Youngblood, but he rather famously was the guy who was protecting Johnson, right?
Yeah, and there's a line. You know, I go into the work of mainstream historians. I read a lot of the books that they put out, not only the famous books, but ones that are used for high school classes. They all sort of dodge around the assassination or just repeat the official story or, just say, well, there's some controversy about it. They don't really go into it. It's a failure of the historians. But Robert Caro is one of the best historians, who's writing a multi-volume history of Johnson, biography of Johnson. He wrote a great book on Robert Moses, but he said in a speech in the 80s that there was a blood feud between the Kennedys and Johnson. And I took him literally, and I thought, well, when he gets to the assassination, is he going to deal with the blood feud? And he does not. He cops out, and he sticks to the official story of the lone gunman, Oswald. And an example is he tells this false story about Rufus Youngblood, who is Johnson's Secret Service man, in the front seat of the car. They were riding in two cars behind Kennedy's. And Youngblood had a walkie-talkie over his shoulder. And in the back was were LBJ, Lady Bird, and Senator Yarborough, who I interviewed. And Penn Jones Jr., who was an independent Texas newspaper editor who broke a lot of the important stories in the case, very gutsy guy, always said Johnson was the only man in the motorcade who ducked, as if he had advanced knowledge of the shooting. And that's because in the famous panoramic photo by James Altkins of the Associated Press of Kennedy being shot, Johnson is a blur in the back seat. He's like a shape leaning forward, and Lady Bird and Yarborough are waving as if still they haven't reacted to the shots, and Kennedy's entered already. But anyway, so I said to Yarborough, what was Johnson doing at the time of the shooting? He said he was leaning forward, and there was a gap between the two front seats, the driver and Youngblood. Youngblood never left the seat. Johnson said Youngblood jumped over the seat and protected him with his body, and Caro repeats that BS. And Yarborough scoffed at that. He said Youngblood never left the front seat, and he said he was a very big man, and you know there wasn't hardly room for the three of us in the back seat anyway without a large guy on, you know, jumping over. Mm-hmm. But he said that Johnson was leaning over, listening to Youngblood's walkie-talkie very intently, and there were two channels. One connected the car to the White House Situation Room and the Pentagon, et cetera, and the other was an internal motorcade circuit. And I think they were probably listening to the one connecting it more widely, and but they were just heavily concentrated on that. And so that's what Johnson was doing. He was very concerned. He was also tied in with a lot of the right-wingers in Texas, oil men, and also police and authorities who were involved in one way or another in the case. And I also found out, to my surprise, I believe Kenny O'Donnell, who was Kennedy's basically chief of staff, was involved as the inside man with the White House. He was supposed to be fired on the Monday after the assassination because the Kennedys had found out that he was financially corrupt and taking money, and he was bad-mouthing the president. They were going to fire him. And you don't read much about that. He's often portrayed as the loyal servant of Kennedy, but his fingerprints are all over some of the planning. For example, the motorcade plan. O'Donnell was the main mover in the plan, which took the motorcade on a hairpin turn from Houston Street onto Elm Street, which is against Secret Service regulations because it slowed down that big car to about 11 and a half miles an hour and it made it a sitting target. And then the car almost came to a stop, or did come to a stop, according to Yarborough and 50 other witnesses. And you don't see that in the Warren, in the Zapruder film, because it was removed. But O'Donnell had other, he was the one who basically ran the operation, he and Kellerman of the Secret Service, to steal Kennedy's body from Parkland Hospital. It was supposed to have an autopsy by the Dallas County Medical Examiner, who did exemplary autopsies on Tippit and Oswald. And if he had done the one on Kennedy, we wouldn't have all the doubts that we have, or many of the doubts about the state of Kennedy's body, which was also altered before the official autopsy in Bethesda, which was a sham. And a lot of these things, you know, it took me a while to believe some of these things that seemed counterintuitive. The body was altered, and there was somebody impersonating Oswald for a long time. But research has come out with very thorough documentation and books dealing with these subjects. And so it's a very different picture emerges. But here's an important historian who gets the story wrong. It's disheartening, but this happens all the time.
Mm. Well, it is interesting. One of the films, which has only been seldom seen, is taken by, I think, O'Donnell.
You're thinking of Dave Powers.
Dave Powers, that's who it was. I'm sorry, because you know why I'm mixing the two of them up? Because Tip O'Neill tells that story about sitting down to dinner with both of them.
Yeah.
And
I could tell that story there.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Powers was, you know, a Kennedy buddy, and he and O'Donnell were in the back seat of the Queen Mary, the Secret Service car, directly behind the president's car. Powers was shooting home movie footage, but he ran out of film before he got to Dealey Plaza. But both of them testified before the Warren Commission, and O'Donnell said shots only came from behind, and Powers more truthfully said he thought, well, he wasn't sure if shots came from another direction or not. But Tip O'Neill had dinner with them, and later, he was the Speaker of the House. He was representing Kennedy.
Right.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Dinner with Tip O'Neill. Years later, Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, and he represented the district that Kennedy had represented, and they both told him that they heard shots from the front, from the Grassy Knoll area, and O'Neill was shocked, and he said, well, why didn't you tell the Warren report and the public? And they said that they were asked not to by the FBI, and that the Kennedy family might have been upset if they had told the truth, and O'Neill thought the truth should have come out, and that's a further mark against Kenny O'Donnell covering up, you know, Mort Saul, who spent a lot of his career investigating the case and suffered, you know, blacklisting from it, said Kennedy had a strange group of friends, remarkably absent when he died, and that's true of O'Donnell and other people that didn't really investigate the case, and they didn't seem to want the truth to come out, but O'Donnell, you know, was mixed up in it. And Powers was a loyal Kennedy aide, but he was not as outspoken as he could have been.
Right. And so, okay, all of this all together, let's swing it around to the key question here. What do you think is the most important reason why somebody needs to read this book? What are you telling us in here that is unique to your book?
Well,
Go ahead.
Yeah, there are some other books on the media and the assassination. I think that they do some good work, but the problem I have with those other books is they tend to be more like catalogs of a lot of quotes and
right.
data without a lot of analysis or context or a thesis. And one of them by Barbie Zelizer, Covering the Body, seems to dodge around. She doesn't say what she thinks about who shot Kennedy, which is a serious problem. I mean, I'm very clear on what I think about the case, and I go into details and I give examples of why I believe certain things. But I also am a journalist from way back, and I understand the media, and I'm a critic of the media. So I write a critical study of the media. It's trying to put it in context and offering a lot of comments on what I think went wrong with the media, what kind of biases they have. I mean, for example, their great need for access. If you start questioning official stories, you won't get called on at press conferences, and then you will be taken off the beat, and you'll lose your job and wind up on a suburban newspaper or something like that. And so a lot of press people are intimidated. And even people, for example, when I offered this book to Political Truth to an editor at Simon & Schuster in the 90s, we can't publish a book like yours because you're attacking the New York Times a lot for lying, and we need the New York Times because they review our books, and that's the kind of economic problem that people run into if they're trying to tell the truth. It causes consequences. And so the media are really corrupt. The press is more corrupt than book publishers, but the mainstream book publishers are afraid to shake the boat either, and they tend to publish only books that are whitewashes of the case. And I do a lot of analytical study of what the media has at stake. As Norman Mailer once told Tom Wicker of the New York Times, he says, I believe you think a lot would be lost if you went to conspiracy. And Wicker, and he wrote the New York Times main story of the shooting that was in the paper the next day, and he quoted the Dallas doctors accurately. They had a press conference at about 3:17 in the afternoon. Malcolm Perry and Kemp Clark, and they said Kennedy was shot in the throat from the front, and they said this repeatedly, and the film of that interview and audio tapes have disappeared, but a transcript was found in the LBJ library, and the shot from the front was twisted into an exit wound from the shot from behind. And that's just false. It was obscured partly by a tracheostomy that Dr. Perry did. But, Tom Wicker quoted that in the New York Times article, but he also said all the shots came from behind, which is a contradiction. And the headline of the article was a sniper. They referred to a sniper in the singular shooting Kennedy. And Wicker was always one of the most vehement and nasty people attacking people who questioned the official theory. He was one of the people who had a vendetta against Oliver Stone for making JFK, which I believe is mostly an accurate portrait of what happened. People often say, well, it's a well-made film, but it's inaccurate. Well, that's not true. What's inaccurate is the official story you read all the time in the New York Times, Washington Post, and other outlets. And Stone's depiction of what probably happened is mostly accurate, right. And a very good film. But Wicker, the New York Times had this crazed vendetta attacking Stone about 30 times the first month the film came out. And, this overheated rhetoric in the media comparing Stone to Leni Riefenstahl, for example, Jack Valenti of the Motion Picture Association compared it to Leni Riefenstahl, and George Will said Stone was an intellectual psychopath, etc. Stone has an interesting new documentary out, JFK Revisited, that Jim DiEugenio wrote. They have a two-hour version and a four-hour version, and they're going into a lot of the documents that have come out since the JFK Records Act was passed after the assassination, after the film JFK. At the end of it, it said many, many records withheld. Why are they withheld? So people clamored to have a law, and so they passed a law. George H.W. Bush, of all people, signed it into law reluctantly, and I have 35 pages into the nightmare on his connections to the case, which I discovered to the Kennedy case.
Well, Bill Clinton enacted it was an agency within the executive branch, and Bill Clinton actually put it into action after H.W. Bush signed it into law. But again, this was based on public pressure. Really quickly, though, just in case somebody doesn't know, and I always thought it was Riefenstahl, but tell us about who Leni Riefenstahl is. They're comparing Stone to her because this is rather significant. I want you to explain that to the audience really fast. You and I know who this is, but maybe not everybody does.
Yeah, she was Leni Riefenstahl, which is the way her name was pronounced, was a propagandist for Hitler who did Triumph of the Will, which is an infamous pro-Hitler documentary, 1934 Nazi Party Congress. Brilliant filmmaking, but very straight fascist propaganda. It came out in 1935, a very frightening film when you see it.
Right.
But that film, I saw it on sale at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, which I thought was commendable because they want people to know what fascism is all about. And Dwight MacDonald, the famous critic, I heard him do a lecture, and he said that film, more than anything else, exposes the nature of fascism very clearly because they're telling us in their own words what they're all about, and it's very well presented. But she is an infamous propagandist, and then she made Olympia, which is sort of soft sell propaganda to some extent. And she went on to a long career denying that she was a Hitler sympathizer, but she was, etc. But to compare Oliver Stone to her is a real slur. I mean, to say like he's like a Nazi and he's a propagandist.
Well, he's a propagandist selling lies is what the key is here. That's what they say. You know, he's that kind of propagandist who is tearing down the government, who is tearing down America, who is, you know, that's the argument that they made, right?
Yeah.
And
the ones who are really propagandists for lies.
Right.
I mean, propaganda by itself is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you could have a propaganda film for world peace, let's say, or whatever, or health or something. But, propaganda, the U.S. government, perfected it in World War One. Noam Chomsky wrote a very good book called Media Control. It's all about how, in World War One and later, the government turned a pacifist country into a belligerent country and put out a lot of, overheated propaganda about the Germans.
Right.
And Hitler, in his book Mein Kampf, has a chapter on war propaganda, and he says, we learned everything from the Americans, which is very chilling. He said our propaganda in World War One was very poor, but theirs was great. And if you compare Stone to that, you're implying that he's a liar and a fascist or whatever, which is all pretty crazy.
Right.
It's Orwellian to accuse him of that because
absolutely.
Jack Valenti, who is a Johnson aide, was one of the big supporters of the Warren Commission, and he ran the MPAA, which is their lobbying association for the Motion Picture Association. It's ironic that he'd attack a big Warner Brothers film because his job was to be their lobbyist. But
is it ironic? Let me ask you this question before we run out of time. Is it actually ironic, given the fact that Hollywood, in general, a lot of people think of Hollywood as, the disparate, decadent land of whatever. But the truth of Hollywood here is that there's a great deal of influence that comes from the government, that comes from the Pentagon, that comes from the, not only the military-industrial complex, literally creating propaganda films sometimes in order for recruitment tools, et cetera. I mean, they're about to release another Top Gun film. We could talk about that at some point in the future. But, I mean, the reality here is that a lot of these films, they don't get made without the consent, advice, and insertion of propaganda from, again, the military, the intelligence community, the government itself directly, and I think various people are not aware of that. So Stone was flying in the face of that government cooperation. That's why they started calling him a propagandist and comparing him to the Nazis as far as the disinformation goes. Because, again, look, say what you will about Riefenstahl and what she did, or Riefenstahl, however you pronounce it. Again, I've only ever read the name, so I don't know how to say it. But thing is, say what you will, the film is extremely well done. And that's literally what they're trying to level at Stone. It's a well-done film, but it's the dirtiest of propaganda. It's anti-American, literally. He's now embraced that sort of, but, you know, go ahead. Say, please,
well,
if you wouldn't mind closing
about
that.
My friend Dave Robb, who's a very good investigative reporter of Hollywood, wrote a book on how the military today influences filmmaking. That, you know, if you make a film that where you need ships and planes and all kinds of apparatus, the government gets involved and they start censoring your script. And, you know, sometimes films are made without government cooperation, like Apocalypse Now. They wouldn't cooperate with that, and Coppola didn't want to get them involved. But it costs a lot more money if you don't have free ships and free airplanes, et cetera. And so there's a lot of propaganda that people don't realize is propaganda that seeps into American films. But once in a while, you know, and I write about some of the honest films, the interesting ones, like The Manchurian Candidate is a great film, 1962, John Frankenheimer. And he also made 7 Days in May, which is about a military coup. And that was ready at the time of the assassination, but they held it back to 64, like Dr. Strangelove was supposed to come out in 63. And that's a very dissenting film, and Kubrick didn't use the military cooperation at all, because it's very anti-military. And so there are some honest films that come out, and I study the films in great detail in my book, as well as books and other things, because the way the public gets influenced is quite often through motion pictures and other forms of entertainment, television. There are a lot of TV documentaries on the case that are dishonest. CBS has done quite a lot of documentaries supporting the Warren Report, and Peter Jennings on ABC did one a few years ago that was really one of the worst propaganda films. And so they're inundated with this propaganda, and to their credit, as they say, they don't always believe this stuff, but they wheel out this propaganda in a big way whenever there's a lot of attention on the assassination, like the 50th anniversary. There were many of these shows that came out, and the 60th is coming up in 2023, and already we're seeing articles, you know, that are starting to come out from the mainstream media rehashing their view of the case, and so the public has to be very critical of this, and that's what I think is important. And you know, people who believe the myths about the 2020 election being stolen and all, they, you know, they get them from propaganda media like Fox News, etc., and lying politicians. But if they do their own research and they find out that 60 court cases all went against Trump, for example, and if they take that seriously, then they won't believe all this nonsense that is forced down their throats. But a lot of people, unfortunately, don't read much, or they read only one outlet, or they don't read critically. So that's what I'm hoping, that a book like Political Truth will foster a more critical view of the case. And I'm trying to get the word out on the book, and I thank you for having me on. It's not the kind of book that gets reviewed in the mainstream press either, and that's the thing, you know. Books like this don't get a lot of publicity unless you use podcasts and blogs, which are great, and there are internet forums discussing the assassination. And Into the Nightmare has been selling very well for 9 years now, steadily, and people all over the world are interested in the case, you know, there are good radio shows on the case, and so it's like two channels of media, you know, just like our divided country, two views of reality, and fake news is a serious problem, and you can alter things like the Zapruder film. It was proven to my satisfaction by Douglas Horn and other people that film was altered by the CIA the weekend of the assassination to remove damaging information. Then it was hidden by Time Life for a long time, finally played at the Garrison trial, and then it played on network TV. Geraldo Rivera put it on, and that helped prompt the House Select Committee to reinvestigate the case. When people saw Kennedy's head going violently backward, they thought, well, wait a second. If you're shot from behind, you know, that's how does your head go violently backward? So it looked like a shot from the front. And that triggered the public interest. But we weren't allowed to see that. Mm. If we had seen that the weekend of the assassination or that week, you know, it would have changed people's perceptions.
Oh, the outcry would not have been delayed.
The real version.
Yeah, the outcry would not have been delayed as it was to the 1970s. And here's the thing to keep in mind as we run out of time. And I'm saying this to the listeners, not to you. You need to read this book now. And I'm going to tell you why. Because as we are in 2022, and as you noted, the 60th anniversary is going to come up. There's going to be various media presentations that I promise you are in production now. Okay, a lot of them. There's always preparation. There's always lead up. We're going to see it. And it's going to be there for the 60th anniversary like it was for the 50th. And like they had prepared for 2017. Even though that was scuttled as far as the release of the documents that were ordered to be released in the 90s and needed to wait 25 years. But anyway, the thing about this is that I think it's a good way for people to understand what it is they're looking at. There are multiple tracks of information. There are multiple streams of reality here. And you're going to have to use some discernment to figure out when you're being fed the official line and when somebody's doing an honest examination. And the problem is there's a middle ground too. Like, you know how you mentioned the Russia thing where it's like, okay, the Kennedy family communicated to Russian officials, we know it wasn't Russia. Well, somebody didn't get that memo at the CIA because they're still doing television shows about it, you know?
Yeah.
And by former CIA guys who are going out there going, well, maybe it was a Russian plot. You know, this again is the weapon of mass distraction. And that has become way more normal than it was even back then, where there is a distraction, there is something else being fed to you. Might be a good idea because it doesn't fit with the official narrative, but some of that is also useful to keep you, what, off the track, off of the real information. So again, you have these books available on Amazon, and also you have some websites. I'm going to try and collect those together for Into the Nightmare and a couple other things. But anything that Joseph McBride has written is A, well written, B, fascinating stuff, especially if you want to study media in general, films especially, and the Kennedy assassination. So at a future time, I'd like to, you know, hopefully the phones will cooperate with us better, and we can get into some other subjects. I want to talk, again, something completely outside of the assassination, and also revisit the assassination with you, because the Tippit case, I got to admit, I have a working knowledge of it, but it's not, you know, my strongest suit, so to speak, when it comes to the Kennedy assassination. So I'd love to break that down with you one day and say, okay, educate me here, tell me what I need to know, and go through Into the Nightmare, which is one of the most extensive pieces ever written on that aspect of the assassination. But today, as I said, I'm advising you, the listener, to get Political Truth, the Media, and the Assassination of President Kennedy. It's kind of interesting. There's the picture on the front, because I'm holding it in my hand. The picture on the front is Kennedy with a newspaper in front of him.
Yeah.
And I find that to be just perfect as a cover.
I love the picture. I got it from the Kennedy Library. It was taken by a White House photographer on August 31st, 1963. He's on his boat in Hyannisport, and he's reading the New York Times with a very skeptical look on his face while he's smoking his cigar, which I think if he were around, he was a journalist himself, and he was talking about running a newspaper when he left office, and he would be appalled by the poor coverage, and he'd have a lot of acerbic things to say about it if he could see what happened after the fact. But he was a critic of the media, too, and I quote a lot of his skeptical comments about the New York Times and other outlets in my book.
Right. No, and that's, again, an excellent book, Political Truth, the Media, and the Assassination of President Kennedy. The author, Joseph McBride, who's been with me for 2 hours, despite the interruptions from the phones and stuff.
Yeah, but thank you, Chuck. Thank you for hanging in there. And, yeah, we had some phone trouble, but the message got through, and it was a good interview. Thank you so much.
Exactly. Thank you, sir. And thank you guys for listening. Remember, I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Go get Political Truth, The Media, and the Assassination of President Kennedy by author Joseph McBride.